From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the elephant in the living room that nobody really wants to talk about, Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. In this hour, the future of Israeli settlements and hopes for a lasting peace. We begin tonight with Bush administration efforts to steady fraying stability in the Middle East. Over the weekend, President Bush shored up support in the Arab world by getting Israel to end the siege of Yasser Arafat's compound in Ramallah. And he agreed to have American personnel help guard convicted Palestinian terrorists. Earlier, I spoke with Patrick Tyler, chief correspondent for the New York Times, and asked if Washington's new commitment may be a step toward American peacekeeping troops on Israel's borders.
That's hard to say. I think that there was very careful negotiations that set conditions, for instance, that these would not be military personnel, that they would be civilian monitors. Obviously, they're going to be essentially guards, and therefore they have to be trained to carry out the detention of these Palestinians who were in the basement of Arafat's compound and the ones in the Church of Nativity that are on some kind of wanted list. I think it is potentially the thin edge of the wedge. I think there's going to be a lot of exuberant debate and discussion and contention over whether that force expands to what some people want it to expand to, which is peacekeepers to get between the parties so that negotiations have a chance.
It's been an incredibly tense, pressurized few days for the Bush administration around the Middle East. Your own report had Saudis warning as Prince Abdullah arrived of the most dire kind of breakdown in U.S.-Saudi relations. Now he will soon be on his way back home. What's your analysis of how the weekend's gone? How's the relationship standing?
I think there's a bit of a mystery here in terms of diplomatic mystery. Obviously, the president has on two previous occasions called the prime minister of Israel and asked him to expedite the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the occupied territories. And this weekend, he succeeded in ending the siege of Ramallah, or we hope so. I mean, it's actually still happening on the ground out there. There could be snags. And I think there's a bit of a diplomatic mystery here about what was different about these conversations, their intensity, what diplomatic instruments, blunt or otherwise, were used. And I think that is one of our reporting objectives for the next few weeks, is to look back at this extraordinary week to see how things turned around and what were the levers and how were they applied.
What's the sense you're getting from the Bush people right now? We've had these incredible reports coming out over deep rifts in the Bush administration between Powell and the Pentagon around the White House. And then, of course, yesterday, the paper's full of talk about the battle plan still being prepared to attack Iraq. Are they feeling that they're on better footing today than just a few days ago?
I think that there are many debates going on in the administration at the moment that you know, when you get right down to it, politics and diplomacy much more tactical than they are strategic. Mm-hmm. At the end, we look back and say this was our strategy. But in fact, politics and diplomacy are kind of a mudslide that we have to get involved in every day in managing a foreign policy where you have enormous pressures coming from multiple directions. So I think Iraq is still out there as a goal, and there are various camps in the administration that would like to go faster and others who would like to go slower. Some who see the resolution of the Palestinian conflict as a precursor for that. Others who say we'd like to just go around it, the Arab world can tolerate it, especially if we're quick and decisive and successful in Iraq. This is going to go on through the summer and into the fall. And I think what we saw yesterday was something broke, though. It was a big crack in the concrete, ending the siege of Ramallah, getting monitors in. I think we're at the beginning of a new phase of diplomacy, not fully sure where it's going, but it's in a direction that's much more activist, and I think the president is much more engaged than he has been in the 16 months of his administration.
At this hour, we are not aware that Yasser Arafat has taken advantage of the Israeli signal that he's free to go. As far as we know, he's still inside a surrounded compound.
Right.
How and where would you expect he might emerge?
Well, I think one of the problems, Tom, is that they've basically got to get a jail first up and running for these fellows who are coming out of the basement, who were charged and tried in the assassination of the Israeli tourism minister, then that jail has also got to accommodate, presumably, the people who are going to come out of the Church of the Nativity, which is a shoe that's going to drop today or tomorrow, it sounds like. So they're just logistical issues that have to be worked out on the ground. I think Arafat will emerge. I think that they will set up some temporary headquarters for him in some building that hasn't been hit by a shell in the last month. And then he will start receiving international visitors and start convening his own leadership to live up to the tasks that President Bush has set for him to really get control of the violence on his end of the street.
Patrick Tyler, as you say, the next step then will be to try to get the two sides, Israelis and Palestinians, negotiating again.
Right.
Yet just in the past few days, Ariel Sharon has said he is not willing to talk at all about settlements during the remainder of his tenure in office. Is it possible to resume political negotiations without a discussion of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories?
No, I don't think so. And I think that both sides will say certain things aren't going to be on the table. But the reality is, if you get a conference going, you're then going to have to look at what the politics are within Israel. And as Tom Friedman wrote very smartly on Sunday, you can get two-thirds of Israelis to sign up for just about anything today because they're desperate, they're anxious, and they want to take some bold step that creates security for them. And they're not sure whether that means backing Sharon, whether that means pulling out and giving the Palestinians their state. You know, at any given hour, they're subject to change their mind. So I think that's going to be a political question that's going to have to be decided in Israel and on the Palestinian, just as there'll be issues on the Palestinian side where you're going to have to develop a political consensus. And remember, Arafat's got Hamas to deal with, a political consensus to make peace.
Patrick Tyler, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Patrick Tyler is chief correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke to us from Washington. The settlement issue is at the heart and soul of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Since the 1967 war, Israel has built settlements in the occupied territories and continues to do so to this day. Even as world leaders search for a political solution to the crisis, the houses go up and Palestinians want to tear them down. Both sides claim a birthright and moral right to live on the land. 200,000 Israelis now live in occupied territories with no intention of pulling out. So, what's the solution? Can there ever be real peace between Israelis and Palestinians without first resolving the settlement issue? What's your solution? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Bethesda, Maryland is Philip Wilcox. He's president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace and former U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem. Good evening and welcome, Philip Wilcox.
Good evening. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Welcome and hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Philip Wilcox, let's plunge right in here. And I guess I'll ask you first. We want to go through the details, but right from the top, can we have a peaceful two-state solution, which is what everybody seems to talk about, without some pullback or more than some pullback of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories? Can it happen?
Tom, it can't happen without a significant pullback from the majority of the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. There's no way that a viable Palestinian state could emerge without the abandonment of the majority of the settlements.
So help us understand, then, the conversation that goes on. There seems to be a fundamental disconnect here. People are talking constantly about longing, working, yearning for a peaceful two-state solution, yet we don't hear so much talk about dealing with the fact of the settlements.
It's a subject that's been ducked over these last 8 years. It was not addressed in the Oslo Accords in 1993. It was put off, unfortunately, during that hiatus when issues were supposed to have been negotiated. The Israelis doubled the number of settlers living in the West Bank, for example. It makes the problem even more difficult to resolve today. However, it is soluble. It'll be a very painful one for Israel, but it can be done. It must be done if there's to be peace between these two struggling peoples.
Philip Wilcox, what are the numbers now? How many Israeli settlers are there in how many settlements?
There are approximately 400,000 Israeli settlers in settlements in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, all of whom were settled in those areas after Israel occupied those areas following its victory in the 1967 war.
We often see that pulled apart into at least two numbers, the 210 or so thousand in the West Bank and Gaza, with the other, I guess what you're putting at nearly 200,000 in East Jerusalem, is a pullback from those long-settled areas of East Jerusalem really a possibility?
Well, there have been discussions on the fate of the East Jerusalem settlements before the negotiating process broke down altogether and Sharon was elected as prime minister. In those discussions, the Palestinian side expressed a willingness to cede those East Jerusalem settlements to Israel in return for Palestinian sovereignty in the Arab-populated areas of East Jerusalem. Indeed, I think that's possible. It would be very hard to dislodge or dismantle those very large urban settlements in East Jerusalem.
Philip Wilcox, paint a picture for us of settlements beyond that area. In the West Bank, there are, I guess, 125 or 26 settlements at this point, we're told, and maybe 19 in Gaza. Let's take the West Bank. What do they look like? How large are they? What's the range in size? How deeply settled? How mobile are these people? Or would pulling back mean leaving behind an enormous infrastructure built over many years?
Yes, it would, but the settlements themselves are varied. They range from tiny little encampments in which people live in portable trailers to very large virtual cities. Yet the majority of the settlers, about 50% of them, live in only 8 very large settlements. The average population in the remaining 140 settlements is only 714. So the smaller settlements can be dismantled without enormous disruption. Most Israelis and Palestinians who have looked at the issue, and indeed those who negotiated it before the system broke down, agreed tentatively that if the 67 line was accepted in principle as the border between Israel and the new Palestinian state, there could be some border modifications which would encompass those large Israeli settlements in return for annexation by Palestine of comparable areas of Israel of comparable size.
So, and briefly, in the last round of negotiations that got so close at the end of the Clinton years and then failed, what withdrawal would they have required of the population from settlements, or was it explicit?
It wasn't explicit, but it would have required the dismantling of the great majority of the settlements, which are the smaller settlements, leaving only those few very large settlements near the 67, so-called green line. They never got down to exact numbers or identifying exactly which settlements would remain. But I think that that is the deal which will ultimately happen.
And yet, Jack Beatty, only last week we're learning that Ariel Sharon is expressing very strong opposition to any pullback from even the smallest settlements.
Yeah, and in their discussions, with his discussions with Secretary Powell brought up some settlements in Gaza and said, you know, it would make a great gesture if you could remove these. And Mr. Sharon said, no, nothing doing. You know, the settlements are, in a strange way, the American taxpayer has been subsidizing them. According to Jimmy Carter, $10 million a day goes to Israel. And money is fungible, so the money that goes to tax breaks and other inducements, we're actually paying for these settlements, and the settlements are the main obstacles to the peace we need to secure our interests in oil and in keeping terrorism, in our own war on terrorism, and in Israel's own security. So it hasn't emerged as an issue for Americans because it's not an issue in American politics. Both parties maintain silence.
And yet, Jack, you know, many Israelis feel that they need those settlements as a kind of front line.
That's right.
Question is, can we have settlements and peace? Is there a genuine chance of peace with Israel's settlements in the occupied territories? Are they necessary to preserve Israel's security? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Can we have settlements and peace? Is there a way for Israel to surrender its West Bank settlements, let's say, and still be safe at home or not? And is Israel politically capable of surrendering West Bank settlements, given the pro-settlement passions there? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Philip Wilcox. He's president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace and a former U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem. Philip Wilcox, give us a sense of the history of Washington's position on settlements. Has there been support, opposition, both?
Our position has become increasingly weak over the years. Originally, the U.S. joined the international consensus, which recognized that the movement of population from the occupying state into occupied territory is a violation of international law under the Fourth Geneva Convention. We held that position firmly until the early 1980s when President Reagan said settlements are not illegal. Since then, we have opposed settlements, but we've abandoned our legal doctrine. We simply say they are an obstacle to peace.
And currently, what do we know about what the George W. Bush administration is saying?
It hasn't addressed settlements. It is a very difficult and sensitive issue. Perhaps for that reason, the administration has not taken it on frontally. It has said that settlements are harmful to peace and there has to be a resolution of the settlements issue, but it has not gone so far as to say what Bill Clinton did in the latter part of his administration, that many of these settlements will have to be abandoned.
How about the Israeli leadership? Is there any sign in Israel that the leadership is prepared to seriously consider discussing with the Israeli population removing these settlements? It sounds like an enormous and expensive and politically hypercharged task.
Quite true. The current leadership is committed to settlements. Ariel Sharon, indeed, was one of the architects of settlements. The real purpose of settlements is to cement Israeli control and domination of the occupied territories. It's a form of modern-day colonialism, and Sharon is devoted to it, as are his ideological colleagues. However, in general, settlements are quite unpopular among the majority of the Israeli public. I believe that if there is a viable peace process in which the Israelis have some assurance of security, they will vote to abandon settlements. It will be very difficult because the settlements are tenacious, they are armed, some of them are ideologically extreme, so it won't be easy. One way the U.S. could ease the process would be to offer compensation to settlers for abandoning their homes in the occupied territories and returning to Israel.
What would the bill be to, if people were even willing to consider or accept that, how much would it cost to compensate people? It would
be very, very high because you're talking of over 100,000 people. So I can't estimate it, but it'll be awfully expensive. However, I think it would be a price worth paying because in the interest of the United States, the Israelis, and the Palestinians, the settlement issue must be resolved. Otherwise, this conflict will continue to fester, and it'll be a continuing, perpetual, violent confrontation.
Philip Wilcox, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Charlie Bernhout. He's a board member for Americans for a Safe Israel. Good evening and welcome, Charlie Bernhout.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Charlie, what's your group's view on the present status and future of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories? Do you see this as land that can and should be given up for peace or not?
Well, first of all, we don't consider it occupied territory because that infers that it belonged originally to these Palestinian people. It certainly, first of all, we don't talk about Palestinians because the Jews were Palestinians in Palestine as much as Arabs. So there really is no, this whole myth of a Palestinian people that was there forever is so ridiculous. And the idea of occupied territories, Jordan actually took over that area, but
It's the language that President Bush and Colin Powell use. It's good enough for us. And
want to call it occupy, but you know, the whole notion of settlement conjures up the idea of tents and sort of temporary cities. These are over 200,000, not 100,000, as the gentleman mentioned, over 200,000 residents of the land of Israel, and they are living in cities of 12,000-15,000, Ariel and Kidumim and Efrat. They have schools and hospitals. These are not temporary places that...
I think we understand that. We may have discussed it before you came on, but Charlie Bernhardt, help us understand. We're talking tonight about trying to understand the link, if there is one, between the settlements and prospects for peace. Do you think that Israel can have peace without the settlements? Can it have peace with the settlements?
I don't think there will be peace as long as Arafat is in control and as long as the Palestinians, I'm calling them Palestinians, but we just see them as Arabs who happen to live in an area that was called Palestine. These Palestinians are dedicated to the destruction of the entire state of Israel. If you look at Arafat's flag, every symbol, everything that he produces shows the entire land of Israel as Palestine. And as long as that's his objective, I think this whole smokescreen of settlement, oh, if we would only give the settlements, there would be peace. Why is it a million Arabs can live in Israel as citizens among 5 million Jews, but 200,000 Jews cannot live among a million Arabs in the so-called West Bank?
Let's put that question to Philip Wilcox. Philip Wilcox.
I've never heard any Palestinian official, nor indeed Palestinian, deny the right of Jews to live in a Palestinian state under a Palestinian jurisdiction. What the Palestinians object to, and it's easy to understand, is the expropriation of land which they regard as theirs and land in which they wish to establish a state of their own next to Israel. It's not just the right to reside there. The settlers demand the right to control and to dominate.
They're not dominating the land, excuse me, and the fact is the Arabs have been building illegally. Why is it all right for Arabs to build in this disputed area? It's not occupied land. It's disputed area. According to the UN Resolution 242 that was adopted in November 22, 1967, they talked about the withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. They didn't say the territories. Purposely, they left out the word the so that there was a negotiation that would take place. It was always intended that there would be a negotiation between the Arabs and the Jews as to which land would be...
That's what we're trying to get to, Charlie Bernhardt, but can we get to peace without pulling back some settlements?
I don't think there will be peace with or without the settlements as long as the Arabs and particularly Mr. Arafat, Hezbollah, and Hamas have as their goal the destruction of the state of Israel.
Then do you imagine perpetual conflict in this part of the Middle East?
No, I think someday, I don't know what miracle will happen, but first of all, we have to get rid of Arafat because he is a terrorist whose only design in life has been to destroy and to kill. And why is it that these people have been kicked out of Jordan, kicked out of Lebanon? They should be kicked out of the West Bank also. The greatest disaster that ever happened was to bring in the PLO and Arafat to control over these poor people.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in. Charlie Bernhardt, hang on a second. I want to bring
you in. They have stolen billions of dollars Arafat has stolen from his own people. He has Swiss bank accounts. If that money from the United States and all the Arab countries went to his own people, there would be peace. But they're living in misery under Arafat also.
Charlie Bernhardt, stand by. I want to bring in our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, here you can hear the passions that make this look like a very insoluble problem.
Yeah, and you can see why American administrations have tended to kick it down the road. Mr. Wilcox used the word dominate, but in fairness, isn't there also a defensive aspect to these settlements? You raised that question, Tom. I mean, Israel has no strategic depth. It can cross it in, 45 minutes or so. Isn't there an aspect, Mr. Wilcox, of the settlements, if not all of them or some of them, that is almost necessary to Israel's security? What about that, Arthur?
No, there isn't. The fact is that in order to protect these many settlements, Israel's security borders have been extended tenfold from the 200-mile border that they have along the 67 Green Line the border with Gaza, the border with Lebanon, to a 2,000-mile border if Israeli forces are needed, as they are, to protect all these settlements from hostile Palestinians. So it totally undermines Israel's hope for security and its right to security. It's an untenable arrangement because to hold onto the settlements, they must hold some 3 million people under a military occupation and use force to do so. The current uprising is a symptom of the situation, and until the settlement issue is addressed, the violence is going to continue, I fear.
Philip Wilcox, Charlie Bernhardt, stand by. I want to bring callers in. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I think it's useful to make a clear distinction between two different wars that are going on. One is a war against suicide bombers and terrorists who are trying to destroy Israel and kill as many innocent Israelis as possible.
Okay.
And it's definitely we have to defend those Israelis and the existence of Israel. Now, there's another war, and that's the war to maintain dominance, and it's the greatest. It's another greatest threat to Israel's security.
But to maintain what dominance, Kevin?
It's the greatest threat to Israel's security now is Messianic Zionism. It is the occupied territories are not. We get the idea of these arguments that they're realists and they're going to be hard nosed. The reality is that there's a belief that's almost a fanatical belief that they're actually sacrificing what a realist would say is their demographically defensible borders. To have 200,000 Israelis scattered about about 2 million Palestinians is ludicrous. It's insane. And it's also not justified. It sounds like a cliche, no justice, no peace. But the reality is the just person will fight aggression. Not only the aggression of others against one's country, but also the aggression of one's country against others. And we have to defend Israel. Israel should have defensible borders. The occupied territories distracts from that. It gives them non-defensible borders, puts them in a situation unjustly occupying another people.
Kevin, let's put it to our guest, Charlie Bernhardt. Charlie, what do you make of Kevin's argument?
Defensible borders, first of all, these numbers of 2,000 miles, I mean, it's ridiculous. Israel's 40 miles wide. I don't know where those numbers come from. But defensible, the whole idea of a Palestinian state that will be a terrorist state, and these gentlemen who are on the line, not one of them could produce any iota of evidence to prove or show in any way that a Palestinian state will be a democracy, a democratic state. It will be another terrorist state, and God forbid it should be created and they invite in. How would we stop Arafat from inviting in Saddam Hussein with tanks and airplanes? And he was supposed to be demilitarized from Oslo. He has about the ship that Katrina A with tons and tons of rockets and ammunition that were geared only for one reason, to destroy the Jewish people.
Charlie, let me ask you something.
Trusted. Mm. So what are we talking about? We're talking about creating a monster. We know that Arafat is a terrorist. He's a liar. He hasn't lived up to one iota of the things that he's agreed to from Oslo on.
Charlie, let me ask you if I could. It sounds like what you're describing, I guess the people, perhaps one reason people don't want to accept this view, some people don't, is that it makes the situation sound hopeless, as though there's going to be unending warfare there. Is that what you foresee?
There's going to be warfare. Look, the hatred that has been taught by Arafat and his people in the schools, what is it that could get a 14-year-old child to wrap himself up with dynamite and want to give his life for jihad and for Allah? This has been brainwashed into these children and the youth and now the women, and it'll take generations for it certainly isn't going to disappear in this generation. They have been filled with such hate and such and they live on such misery that's caused by their own people because, and look, Barack offered the moon just a couple years ago with Clinton. He offered them 98% of what they were looking for, and Arafat turned it down.
That's an interesting point. I want to turn to Philip Wilcox on that. Philip Wilcox, was it the moon that Barack offered Arafat?
No. Barack didn't offer them 97%. Barack offered them. He never offered numbers. He never offered a map. He spoke in terms of 90% of the occupied territories, but if you try to extrapolate that on a map, what it looked like was three scarcely connected enclaves, which could not have produced a viable Palestinian state. No Palestinian leader could have accepted that. Arafat was foolish to walk away from those talks. He should have said, this represents some progress, let's keep talking. He didn't say that, but they did keep talking, and they arrived at a much closer, more realistic agreement tentatively during the next 6 months. It was too late, however. The Sharon government came in, and the Sharon government has no interest in a realistic territorial
That's
compromise.
A lie. Sharon wants peace as much as every Israeli and every
Charlie Burnett, let's be careful about calling that a lie.
Peace is ridiculous.
Let's go to the phones. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. We're discussing the issue of the settlements here, and I saw that the talk has deviated a little bit. But to answer the question of the settlements, if the issue of the settlements is going to be solved, then it's really going to demand a more leadership role from the U.S. Only the United States can put pressure on the Israelis to really dismantle the settlements and take them down.
John, do you think the U.S. is prepared to do that?
The U.S., well, if the U.S. is really interested in forcing peace into that region for it not to disturb its interests with all the Arab countries, then it has to step up to the plate. Like the speaker talked, those settlements are financed by U.S. dollars. They are financed by taxpayers' money from the United States. And if we're really interested in really bringing peace to that region, then they have to go. They're illegal. Sharon built, ever since he came to power, I think 34 settlements. In the past year and a half. So where's the will for peace?
Well, we've got your point, John. I want to put it to Jack Beatty. Jack, do you see, I guess, the U.S. government as being straightforward in its public conversation about the implications of the settlements?
No, I don't. And I think it's for substantial political reasons. Neither the Democrats nor the Republicans want to bring this up. The Republicans, because they'll be attacked by the commentariat, right-wing conservative writers, and the Democrats, because American Jews are an important constituency. But, you know, polls show, there was a recent article in the American Prospect magazine citing poll numbers showing the gap between American Jews on this issue and the leadership of American Jewish lobbies. That basically the rank and file American Jewish American says, well, if it comes to that, we may have to give up the settlements for peace. Whereas the lobbies, partly because of the nature of lobbies, have to go for 100%. And unfortunately, both parties sort of adjust to the political pressure rather than to what you might call the silent majority behind it.
Charlie Bernhardt, let me give you the last word in this segment. Where do you see the strongest support for sustaining settlements in the West Bank and Gaza?
I just have to correct the gentleman about American Jewry. American Jewry is misinformed. They're misinformed by the New York Times, which is so anti-Israel and anti-Semitic, in my opinion.
We've just got 20 seconds, Charlie.
Okay. The settlements are going to stay. They are part of Israel. And someday we hope for peace. We pray for peace. It can only happen once Arafat is out and Hezbollah and Hamas are not in power. And the Arabs really want to have peace. They'll sit down and they will have peace someday.
Charlie Bernhardt, thanks very much for joining us. Charlie Bernhardt is a board member of Americans for a Safe Israel. We're talking about Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Can we have settlements and peace? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, over 200,000 in the West Bank and Gaza. Can the settlements stay and there be a reasonable chance of peace? Can Israel be safe without the settlements? Can it have peace and settlements? And what should Israel and the U.S. do if pro-settlement Israelis will not agree to a pullback, simply won't agree? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now by Natan Gutman. He's Washington correspondent for the Haaretz Daily. Good evening and welcome, Natan Gutman.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks so much for joining us. Give us a reality check here, Natan Gutman. Is there any chance under the Sharon administration of the settlements being given a real discussion in the context of a peace process? And what about beyond Sharon? What are the politics of Israel today when it comes to the settlements?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that Prime Minister Sharon just a week ago announced in a cabinet meeting that his own government will never uproot settlements, even not if we're talking about small and isolated settlements. So I think Sharon's view about that is very clear. Mind you, we should remember also that the Sharon government has agreed to the Mitchell Plan, which calls for a freezing of new buildings in the settlement. So he might show a certain willing to stop building new settlements, but not for uprooting existing settlements.
But Natan, do you think that there's a chance of peace emerging with a freeze, or will it require a pullback? And what are the Israeli politics around a pullback?
But I think Israeli public is aware of the fact that a real peace accord will require a pullback and dismantling of settlements, maybe not all the settlements, but of part of them, and of bringing the settlers back into the 1967 borders of Israel. Right now, the political scenario would be, if a settlement like that could be reached, then we would expect, Israeli public would expect the Labor Party, led by Benjamin Ben-Eliezer and Shimon Peres, mm-hmm. to leave the government and actually form an opposition from outside. Right now, we have a national unity government. They would expect them to leave the government and go to elections with a question, do we uproot settlements or not?
And if it came to that, who does it look like might win? Can you tell? What do the polls suggest?
It's hard to tell, especially in the current situation where Israeli public lost its trust in the Palestinian leadership, mm-hmm. and the views are that even if we are willing, so people say, even if we're willing to give up the territories, we're not willing to give them to Yasser Arafat because he can't be trusted. But polls show all the time that at least 50% of the Israeli public is willing to withdraw back to more or less the 1967 lines, which means dismantling certain settlements. This was never brought up to vote in Israel, so it's hard to know how things will be once it is. But in considering the fact that it will be part of a peace agreement and probably over a long period of time, I think this might have a majority mm-hmm. of Israelis supporting that.
Natan Gutman, I know we just have you for another minute, but we have heard analysts say that there might even be armed conflict between Israelis if there was a serious attempt to pull these settlements back. Is that realistic to your ear, or does it sound like exaggeration?
It's not an exaggeration, but we should just briefly recognize the fact that there are two different kinds of settlers. There's the majority of settlers which will leave peacefully if they'll be asked to do so, and we probably won't put up a fight. We have a small hardcore of settlers which are ready to fight as much as needed, even against Israeli soldiers, and just against leaving the territories. We saw that also when Israel pulled back from the Sinai Desert with a peace accord signed with Egypt, and there was a small group of settlers which wasn't willing to leave. Eventually, they were forced out by Israeli soldiers. It was very unpleasant, and it's a scar in the Israeli history, but that thing happened, and the Israeli army overcame it.
The emotions clearly run very deep. Natan Gutman, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Let's turn to our callers. Mohammed is on the line. Welcome, Mohammed. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Tom, with all respect due to both the sides in this conflict, first of all, I think that Sharon cannot bring peace to the Mideast, as he cannot give up any settlements. The second point, as we've all been hearing that Arafat is a terrorist, okay, but Arafat was brought back after he was kicked out of Lebanon by the whole world. Why we have been dealing with Arafat again and again and again? That's the question. The third thing, Sharon administration truly, I believe, with all my heart, does not treat Palestinians as human beings. One simple example, when settlers' children are diving into the swimming pool, there is 1 hour of water coming to Palestinians to drink. This is a reality. It's not from a movie that I'm telling you.
Mohammed, what's the solution? What's the solution?
The solution is, first of all, we talk at least to Palestinians thinking that they are the same children of Adam. Then only we can talk peace. When we think that the other party, listen, there are probably 200 nukes Israel has. They can nuke the whole Arab in 30 minutes.
But what's the solution, Mohammed? Just a complete pullback, or is there a more practical way, since you know the passions on the Israeli side of this as well and their fears as well?
Yeah. The more practical solution is no dismantling. With all respect to the Jews and the Muslims and the Palestinians over there, there has to be a land given by Israel if they are not going to dismantle all the settlement. A land which is not barren, which is fertile, as they have taken from the West Bank and Gaza illegally.
So you might say if some settlements have to stay, then there should be compensating land.
Fully. And not that. The biggest lie, Tom, that 90% was given in that accord, that was the biggest lie because that was legitimizing the total hegemony of Israel over all the pockets of the settlement and all this humiliation of taking out the shirts and showing to the whole population. Do you think, Tom, that we can imagine this kind of humiliation in America? No way. We live for justice and freedom.
Well, we take your point, Mohammed. I want to put your practical solution to Philip Wilcox. Our time is running down. Philip Wilcox, Mohammed says, if some of these end up having to stay because they're so developed, some of the settlements, what about compensating land from Israel? That's hard to picture. Can you see it?
Yes, I can. And I think that has been discussed at some length among Israeli and Palestinian negotiators before the process broke down. I think that is the shape of a solution. Some of the large settlements will stay. There'll be compensating land swaps on the Israeli side of the line. I think that's the way it will end. I certainly agree with Mohammed that there are basic questions of equity here and fairness, and unless there's a solution that is fair, then the conflict will continue.
But how do we open this conversation up in a way that Israelis can feel confident in their fundamental
absolutely.
National security?
And there cannot be an end to the violence or a dispassionate addressing of the settlement problem until Israelis feel a sense of security. Israelis are afraid now because of terrorism and particularly this ugly phenomenon of suicide bombing. So it is quite right that the settlement problem and these other issues of land and borders must be coupled with a solution to the security issue. That's critically important, and there will not be an Israeli withdrawal until the Israeli public is satisfied that the deal on the table will protect their security in the future. That's critically important, and that's got to be part of the solution.
Are we anywhere near that? We hear repeatedly tonight that Yasser Arafat has got to go before Israelis can be comfortable.
I think it's a dodge. I think there's a tendency to demonize Arafat and to characterize the Palestinians somehow as people who are essentially violent terrorists, that there's some kind of primordial hatred at work here. I don't believe that, and I've worked closely with Israelis and Palestinians over the years. The problem is a dispute over land, and that's the dispute that is at the heart of the issue. If that is resolved, there can be peace and there can be security. Mm.
Philip Wilcox, our time is running out. We thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Philip Wilcox is president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. He's former U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem. Jack Beatty, just got 10 seconds. Wow. How do we ever get past this stone?
I think what you said originally is true. The United States is going to have to play a bigger and bigger role. Look what we did over the weekend. I mean, who thought that could be worked out? That's a model of what's got to come.
Steps can be taken. Jack, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online on our new forums. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a diary from an American teacher looking back on her experiences teaching in Israel in the late 1960s. This is On Point. In 1968, Marilyn Bentov went to Jerusalem to teach high school English. The current news from Israel has caused her to reflect on her experiences there decades ago and to find a message of peace from an earlier era of a nation forever in conflict.
From 1968 to 1970, I lived in Jerusalem on Agron Street near the Jaffa Gate. I had come with my 11-year-old daughter, whose father had been a member of the Israel Science Corps. He wanted his daughter to have the experience of living in Israel. A bare few weeks after we arrived, we were sitting on our balcony and chatting with Israeli teenagers when the air exploded. We were nearly blown over. My daughter, blue-white and shaking, asked as calmly as she could, "What was that?" 14-year-old Michael shrugged, "A bomb. An explosion." "What do you do?" she asked. "Nothing. That's how it is. That's life in Haaretz, life in our country. Oh. Her oh, a sigh of relief was intense. After all, Michael wasn't upset. No one seemed upset. In that instant, my daughter understood that the response to terror in Israel was to hide your fear and keep cool. And cool was how she learned to act. But I began to wonder and worry about what this Israel experience was teaching my child. During this time, I taught English to an 11th grade class at the Hebrew University High School. This was a school for the intellectual elite, those who made it through matriculation exams and survived army service, went on to college, professions, and nation-building careers. I loved my students. They were resourceful, self-reliant, well-informed, unafraid, helpful, respectful, innocent, unsophisticated, and incredibly mature. In short, they had what it takes to become an adult in a country forever in crisis. At the end of the academic year, I invited my class to my apartment. Jonathan's mother, widow of an officer killed in the Six-Day War, called to thank me. A visit to the home of an American English teacher for these children is as good as going to Parnassus, she said. I was a little surprised, and I was moved. Jonathan's mother had lost her husband. Her son had lost a father people remembered with admiration. Visiting with my class hadn't seemed that big a deal to me. But it was, perhaps more for me than for them. Packed together on the floor in my tiny living room, the 40 kids whom I'd worked with so hard to forget the grammar rules and speak with confidence, spoke. They poured out their feelings, their struggles to clarify direction, to make clear choices, to detect empty slogans, and to resist false rewards. They offered me their hearts, and they won mine. In 1974, I learned that Jonathan was killed in the Yom Kippur War. He was 22. This life cut short broke my heart. I recalled a sentence in an essay he wrote on George Orwell's story, Shooting an Elephant. I now understand that no matter what we give, better health or education, to the Arabs in the territories, it is nothing until we give them their independence. Jonathan had made the connection by himself. In that 11th grade classroom where I taught, helicopters flew by almost daily from Suez, transporting wounded soldiers to Jerusalem. The droning noise would turn all heads, boys and girls, to the large window on the south wall, where silently they fixed their eyes until the plane was gone. They had a bitter slogan in that class, "See you next year on the memorial plaque." When I lived in Jerusalem, I used to see a graffiti scrawled on walls everywhere. It read in Hebrew, "Stop killing." Now, watching and mourning the continued senseless mutual slaughter of Palestinians and Israelis, I feel like we need to write that graffiti in the sky all over the world.
Marilyn Bentoff lives in Newton, Massachusetts. Diaries like this begin with emails from listeners like you. Before they're recorded, they start out as essays of about 750 words in length. How are the news stories you're reading, watching, and hearing affecting your life? We'd love to hear from you. Send your submissions for future audio diaries to onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBU.